namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. So my respects and best wishes to you all, and many of you come from quite a way, from America and Italy and Scotland and kinds of places, just for this occasion. You didn't come to see me. So I'm the kind of B-movie. tonight I've been asked to give some reflections about my time and my perceptions and my anecdotes and stories of Lumpur Samedo. And I don't normally do a lot of anecdotes and stories, partly because they're always, you know, memory is a strange, distorting thing. You know, you remember something and that's my perception of it, and it's still all the time. It's only a fragment of the truth. But in a way, whenever I reflect on my teachers, I do regularly. You know, it helps to give one a sense of connection, the value of a teacher. It's not Dhamma's not a theory. It's not a system. It's not a technique. Mostly, the most important, in my opinion, for me, the most important thing one learns from is other humans. And so this particular person has been a big feature in my life for nearly 38 years. That's the longest time I've known anyone in my life, apart from my brother, but I've seen more of Lumpur Samedo than I have of my brother. Yeah, so it's a very powerful, presence, and that's what I've been with and learned with, and you know, bounced off, and you know, been confused by, and been inspired by, and been received by, and been welcomed by, and sometimes been ignored by. Well, seemingly, so all the various things, and yet still, there's a very strong sense of this person has a huge amount of Dhamma integrity and Vinaya integrity, and something one I can learn from. So I recollect, you know, particular things that stay in my mind, and they're my memories, my perceptions, but they remain as like little fragments that I put on my shrine, the shrine in my mind. You know, so when I recollect, I can, there's that, and there's that, and a particular feeling of, you know, inspiration comes from that. So I can offer some of these. And I think it's a really important thing to do, to recollect one's teachers, one's parents, you know, teachers, both ordinary teachers and Dhamma teachers, because these are all, you know, they all get, you know, carried into our citta and become part of our citta. We're not really separate. We're always like a stream that's absorbing influences from other people. You know? And there's a lot of weird stuff and strange stuff and painful stuff. And then occasionally you get something that's really giving you a very strong current that's moving you. You know? And it's this power of the Dhamma manifesting through a particular person that is so precious, so valuable, and so important to hold in the right way. Mostly because, of course, here we are, you know, understanding, as Lumpur himself would say, Lumpur Samedo is a perception in the mind. You know, there's no real fixed person there. Yeah. all perceptions are impermanent. Yeah, so as this, we're acknowledging that perceptions, people are impermanent formations that arise in their minds, and yet they are perceptions and impressions that can have huge guiding influences on our mind, and we take and we store up the ones that we find beautiful, and we contemplate the ones we question or still trying to figure out or make sense of. And to me, this is the way one intimately absorbs one's teacher and one's fellow practitioners. And hopefully, as we live our lives, we're also, you know, giving skillful or hopeful, helpful impressions to others who can take that on. So it's a very interesting field of sharing, the field of perception and the human manifestations of Dhamma. So if we look at it in that light, you know, because it's so significant that someone, I think we would all say huge, you know, if you say one word, you say one word about Lumbar Samhita, you say big. You know, it's only physically big, enormous impression, strong energy, seems to create a lot of powerful things, seems to happen around him. If he comes into a room, his energy, his presence fills the room. Very large something, a big lot of nothing, you know, but a huge amount of of something. And yet, you know, and as I have the privilege of occasionally going to his kuti and seeing him individually, and he say, I haven't done very much. You know, I just like to, you know, quietly sit on my own. I don't have very much to say. He always says, I haven't got much to teach, I haven't got much to say. And he always experiences his own personality just as some kind of rather, you know, quirky thing that's nothing to make a big deal out of, you know. And in a way, that's also true. Yeah. But with or beneath or somehow in, there's also, along with that personality is the vehicle, or the vessel, or the channel through which this tremendous quality of parami manifests, you know. And how we need that, you know. You try living with a book and see how good that feels after a few years. You try, you know, feeling really miserable and going to a book and asking it to help you. You try getting really disillusioned with practice and feeling fed up with yourself and go and talk to a book and see what it does. You try asking a book to build a monastery. Yeah, it's not going to do it, is it? Yeah. So this incredible phenomenon, as I think some people have said, didn't, you know, Theravada Buddhism, what's that, you know? And how did this get here? And it's through this person. Certainly not alone. But one thing about Lumpo, he's got tremendous valency, you know. I don't know if you're familiar, like, valency is to do with atoms. Some atoms can only take one other molecule. They form like hydrogen, can only take one other. You know, you can only bond with one other hydrogen atom. Oxygen, you can bond with four. And Lumpo Samhita is like uranium. It's 128. There's a lot of people can have access to it. A lot of people can find something there they can connect to. And so there's this immense ability to be, represent something, you know, that, you know, a huge number, a range of people, not just Buddhists, but huge number of people can get some access to and some feeling of that feels good, that feels true, that's interesting, that's livable, that's what I want. I want to be with that, you know. And not just, certainly not just Buddhists, he used, not just Theravada Buddhists, he used to teach for, I think, 18 years at the Buddhist Society, at the Leicester Summer School, where he taught regularly with a Korean Zen monk and a Tibetan Rinpoche, and they had a great time together, you know. And he used to do a lot of interfaith things with, he had a Christian Buddhist seminar here one year, I think that was the 1980s, 1990s, at Amrawadi. And again, he had not just Christians, but Christians, it was Jain, Hindu, a range of religions just getting together and had a great time, talking about the sacred and the challenges of trying to live a religious life. So it's a tremendous capacity to present something that's universal and yet not lose contact with his primary inspiration, Lumpur Cha and the forest tradition and Theravada Buddhism in Thailand, maintaining integrity to that, like someone who puts their taproot down in that, but is able to branch out from that taproot and present something very universal and very multifaceted. And that is just, I don't know anyone who's done that. Anyone else has done that to that, anything like it. So, you know, you think of Master Hua, the Chinese Chan master, who, very strong connection with Lumpur Samedo. And because of that, that's how Abhayagiri Monastery, one of the prime reasons why Abhayagiri Monastery got established, because of their connection. You know, that's a Chan master, didn't, you know. So all these various Dalai Lama, you know, and so Buddhists, Christians, non-Buddhists, right down to ordinary meetings, you know, like how many of the community here, you know, were kind of penniless students, and Ajahn Mun came and gave a talk at their Buddhist society. And they thought, oh, and they end up being, you know, Ajahn's 20 years, you know, 15 years later. Because this one monk turned up and he showed something that they felt, oh, that's good. That's interesting. I can do that. You know, remember one of the monks, he met this and just went on a train, you know, and he found this bhikkhu, you know, was just such an incredibly humorous and warm person. They had a great time together. He didn't realize he was abbot of a monastery, and he ended up becoming a bhikkhu and an ajahn and so on. Mm-hmm. So this tremendous valency, the ability to be accessible to a wide range of people. Mm-hmm. You know, if you look at the community, you got people who are students, dancers, school teachers, you know, a whole range of people, and all that, you know. When we talk about Lumpur Samedo, we also talk about, you know, where did the nuns' order come from? Certainly it came with Ajahn Sundar and Ajahn Chandasiri, but, you know, they were great and so forth. You can't deny their parami, but there wouldn't have been a nun's order without Ajahn Sumedho. You know? Because certainly who else made the connection to Thailand apart from him? Who else gave that its ground? I mean, I did a lot of the detailed stuff, and that was kind of Lumpur's thing. He would set the basic thing, get the thing established, and then he'd be able to, by not even by willpower, but just by who he was, attract others who then start to do all the detailed stuff. You know, Ajahn Vajiro, Ajahn Amaro, myself, Ajahn Jitindro, Ajahn Manindo, do all the detailed stuff. But without him, there wouldn't have been any stuff to do details on. It would just have been, you know, where does the basic thing come from? You know? And so people like George Sharp, you know, English Sangha Trust, you know, what was happening before he turned up? Nothing. You know, it was kind of empty place. They'd already decided that it's impossible for bhikkhus to live in Britain. That was about 71, 72, I think. They decided, the last speaker had said, you just can't do it in this country, it's impossible. And then, as I think Lumpur will talk about tomorrow, the example of Ajahn Panyavado, but certainly it was one large American turning up in Hampstead who was the critical factor for that, you know, that all bonded around. And doing what, you know? Basically, as he said, I didn't come to teach Buddhism. I'm not here to bring Buddhism to the West. I practice the Dhamma Vinaya. I've been invited to receive the four requisites. There are good people here. Just keep going. That's it, you know, and let the rest of it happen around it. No particular agenda. Just do that. And throughout all the various things that Lumpur sort of tried on, moved out to, picked up, explored, it always come back to that. Always come back to that fundamental thing, you know. You're here to practice the Dhamma Vinaya, and to deepen into that. Everything else fits into that. So the beauty of that is somehow it was neither exclusive, because he could take on, you know, sometimes we're talking about mystical aspects of Christianity, you know, or Nagarjuna, Mahayana, or, you know, these various other, and he'd take that in and absorb it and pull it back to the Dhamma Vinaya. So it was non-exclusive. You know, it includes many things, yet he'd always connect it back to this taproot. And that to me is always a kind of amazing. He didn't get lost in it. He didn't spin out. So very big and very firmly rooted in the ground, direct experience, living, training as a Buddhist monk, and relying on direct experience. And that, you know, is both very clear, very direct, very grounded, and also gives a lot of capacity to receive and reflect on human condition, culture, religions, getting old, politics, you name it. You listen to his talks, they all come in there, and they all turn around, those themes to all turn around that, and he could bring it all back to this, you know. So, although I'll take leave just to say a few words about myself, I don't so feel always it's so, you know, appropriate to just give personal history. But it gives you an idea when I talk about Lumpur, who's talking, you know, my angles. And I had taken on bhikkhu training, not with Lumpur Cha, but more or less by accident. I was traveling and I really realized I needed to connect to something. You know, I was just getting so bored with the world. And running around and doing this, that, and the other, just to get sit down and find something meaningful to do. And I was in Thailand, which I didn't know much about at all, but it sounded good. I'd read about one paragraph on it. It sounded good. Buddha was cool as far as I was concerned. Sounds nice, happy people, I'll do that, you know. So I was in India, then I went to Thailand, because when I was in India, I tried to get something spiritual and I just couldn't get it. And one of the reasons why I couldn't get it was there was always some kind of load of stuff you had to take on. Belief in a guru, belief in some cosmology, and a lot of devotion to a teacher. And I just couldn't get that going. My mind was much too rational and cynical for that. So I'm, you know, come from rational, cynical basis. I'm not a devotional person. I haven't been anyway. So, but I've realized, well, I saw some meditation being advertised. I thought I'll go to that, at least help me to get my head together when I was in Thailand. And so I started doing that, and I realized pretty quickly the fact that I could watch the mind at all somehow meant that I wasn't my mind, and I needed to do more of this. So I spent 3 years altogether. And then I was taught in this system, the Burmese Satipatthana system, and I don't want to really make a sweeping statement about it, but the way I was taught it, my teacher had only done it for a year or so himself, I was basically in this little hut for 3 years. There was no conversation for 3 years. There was no tea together for 3 years. There was no eating together for 3 years. There was no pujas for 3 years. There was just, we were allowed to go bindaban in silence. That was the event. And then it was back to your hut. And then we do this very intensive, well, that's intensive enough already, Burmese Satipatthana, where you're supposed to make a mental note of everything. Like you hear a sound, noting hearing. You lift your hand, noting lifting. You do everything very slowly. You walk around very slowly. You're noting, intending, about to lift, lifting, moving, touching, feeling something, intending, lifting, touching. So you've got this kind of thing going on in your brain, reporting everything that's going along. That was what was happening for me. I did this for 3 years. I was nearly, I was not in a good state. But I was intense. It was intense, whatever else it was. It was very intense. And I don't say that's the way it is for everybody or that's the right way to do it, but that's the way I was doing it. We had one thing we did, which was the teacher said, well, to get really focused, to get really attentive, to get really mindful, you take your alms bowl, fill it with water until the water stands above the rim of the bowl, and then pick it up and walk with it without spilling any. You try it. You know, because the meniscus of the water stands above the rim of the bowl, so you just, a slightest, it's going to flow over. So it was intense. You know, so that was meditation to me, was that kind of extremely intense concentration on a point. And so I was getting intense. So in the middle of this, somehow I got sent off to Chiang Mai to do super intensive, stop fooling around. And so I stayed in a monastery where I've been recommended to go to so I could do this thing. For 6 weeks. And somewhere in the middle of that, the monks in the monastery knocked on my door and said, oh, you have to come. You have to come. What? I'm getting intense. I'm busy. No, you have to come see Sumato. Well, what's Sumato? Ajahn Sumato is coming to town. You must go see him. Oh, Sumato. American monk. Oh God, American monk. And he's with Ajahn Chah. I just kind of seen a few things about Ajahn Chah, very little. I'd seen some kind of photostatic thing going round, which is talking about how austere it was, really austere. Oh my goodness, I'm intense and miserable enough already. And I'm going to meet somebody who's been doing this for 10 years and is austere as well. This is not going to be much fun. So I imagine some kind of really tight, shriveled marine. Anyway, I'll go just because, I am their guest and they've been nice offering me a place, so I'll go. And so went along and took me to a house. And as you probably know, the ground floor of the house in Thailand is often open. The sort of stands on legs and the ground floor is open. He was sitting on a big chair. And he had Ajahn Babakra was sitting next to him on the ground. These two monks are both big. And we came in and we paid our respects. And the Thai monks kind of had a little chat. And then they disappeared. So there I was. And he said, well, I've been asked to come here and give a talk. But nobody's turned up. So there I was, and it was Ajahn Sumedho as he was then, and I spent three hours with him. And, you know, the impression is just this kind of warm, open, you know, steady, warm, open, and quite gentle as well. I mean, I don't know what we talked about, but that wasn't the point. It's just this presence. I didn't experience anything like that before, ever. And this, you know, and the kind of modesty. I mean, they brought in some tea and he insisted on pouring me a cup of tea and offering me a cup of tea first before he took his own. He didn't have to do that. You know, these little things one notices. There's a modesty and a gentleness and yet this huge presence of something very warm and simple and steady. Wow, you know, that's different. And he said, I've been asked, this was 76. Yeah, about November, December 76. And he said, I've been asked to start a monastery in Britain. Oh, yeah. And he said, yeah, somewhere in Somerset, inviting him to start a monastery in Somerset. Okay, well, good luck. I can't imagine a monastery. One of my perceptions of Somerset were kind of cider-sipping yokels. Well, that was interesting, wasn't it? And I couldn't place that presence, but it stayed there. And then we went our separate ways. I went back to being intense. but it had started a kind of question in my mind, like, what's that? What's that? That person, what have they got? Where have they got to? You know? There's more in this than just the meditation technique. And so the 76, and then a year and a half later, my father died. So I had to go, I felt to go back to Britain to sort out my affairs and be with my mother for a while. And my teacher then, he had connection to Ajahn Panyavado, as most, I think most, there was a kind of farang network of monks who passed things on the grapevine. They said, oh, this Sumedho's in London now. Here's his address. You look him up. Oh, okay. You know, another little gift. So I came to Britain, I sorted some things out, and it was extraordinarily difficult. Because I'd been 3 years, can you imagine, 3 years in solitude, in a hut, not speaking, apart from just a few, you know, reports to my teacher, which 10 minutes or so, and you'd be living in complete sensory isolation, and suddenly you go out of that into, you know, a non-Buddhist country trying to operate, and your family's in a state of chaos trying to deal with the death of the parent. And after about 6 weeks of that, I was just ready to, I'd lost it all completely. My little intensive noting and intending really wasn't doing much good on that level. I remember just somewhere just going out and standing in the rain just as I could try to get grounded because I was just so blown away by it all. And I don't think I would have stayed. Don't think I'd have survived as a monk, actually. So I went down to Hampstead, and it was whether I was going to survive as a monk was very touch and go at all. It was just, I just couldn't see how this thing could relate to anything, what I could continue doing. And I knocked on the door of the Haverstock Hill Hampstead Vihara, and the door opened. It was quite a small Vihara, and this big figure was filled the door frame. Yeah. Oh, hello. And he recognized me. He said, I know you. And come in. And that image, because in some ways it was like, when you think about it, Ajahn Sumedho is the door, and the door opens, and you walk in. And so then that was absolutely crucial. There was Viradamo and Nando, Ajamajira was at Anagarika then, and there was a few other, and a couple of two or three other Anagarikas, and I think Ajahn Vimala was around as a kind of a lay person, his lovely sense of humour and spontaneity. So it's a real kind of human quality to it. We went, and we things like eating together and drinking tea and talking with each other and going out. Well, this is wonderful, you know. So we're going Bindabad and Art Hampstead Heath, and it was all really wonderful just to feel coming out of this very tight box, but being able to sense that, you know, the bhikkhu is something you can live it. Before then, I'd really just been a person wearing robes. You know, I'd been a person meditating wearing robes. I hadn't been a bhikkhu. And then I thought, well, this is new, this is fresh, this is interesting, this is alive. This is not something you're doing with your attention, this is something that wraps around you and carries you. And it's lived and you can share it. And so I thought, well, I'll stay with this for a while. I'd only decided to come to Britain for a few weeks. And I thought, well, 6 weeks maybe, but then I thought I'd stay for the Vassa. So then we went out to Oxfordshire for the rains. The Hampstead Vihara, although it was a refuge, was a very tight box. And I think Ajahn Viradamo and Nando particularly were suffering quite a lot from having, they were very junior then, and just being stuck in London. You know, they were feeling a bit wilted by it all. So we went out, fortunate enough, this Burmese family offered us a place in their country house. They had about 40 acres of land, this country house with lots of land. And they offered us a section of the house, and I was in the gatehouse, and there were various huts, rather like the Amrawadi huts, actually, that they built in order to do retreats. So they were devout Buddhists. So we went there and spent the rains there. And during that time, there was myself, Ananda had gone to France, there was Ajahn Viradamo, myself, Aranyabo, and were you there? You were there. And there was a couple of other Anagarikas and three Samaneras, wasn't it? Bhadia and Kondanyo and Sadakara, right? Yeah. And it was not exactly it was fairly, people were going through experiences. And just to, you know, remind the lay community, you know, when people take on the holy life, it's a very, very radical overhaul. And all your things that normally hold you steady, like your relationships, your ability to go places, your comfort zones, all that's taken away. And people start to just dissolve in a way and start to get all kinds of strong mood swings and getting up early in the morning and sitting still for a long time and being with the same thing day after day, stuff starts busting out, you know. And people get blow up and people get sulky and people collapse and people argue, fight with each other, you know, and all this is happening. And Ajahn Sumedho was there with all that, and it was very much like very direct. None of us knew anything about, you know, etiquette or the kind of skillful monastic etiquette that the Thai monks have. It's gentle and it's spacious and they know how to do things politely. We were just rude, direct, raw and ugly. And, but there was another Anagarika Jordan, who later became a monk, who was larger than life too. And there was Anagarika Sean, who became Ajahn Jayasaro. So there's a whole bunch of these people, all pretty new and fresh. And I think Ajahn V had about three vassas. So there was no sense of there being a whole kind of stratum of senior experienced people holding together. It was all newcomers. I think Lumpur himself has 12 vasas at that time, which is, you know, so there he was starting in a new country, new continent that he'd never been to before, that didn't really know what Buddhist monks were about, with a bunch of newcomers. And he was, the, you know, all resting on him in a very uncertain situation. He didn't have a monastery even. If they were just, we were just guests in somebody's house. So there was this totally insecure, unsteady situation. And during that time, we had morning puja and evening pujas every day. And he gave, I think, 2 talks a day throughout the entire vasa. So add that up. Every day, 2 talks. Every day, morning talk, evening talk, every day. And it was always just the same tone, the same steadiness. And one thing I've noted about Lumpur is he'll pick up a particular theme and he'll bring it back again and again and again and again and again. You know, and I, you know, when he's saying the other day, I say he only says one thing. That's not a condemnation. That's actually the sense of the steadiness and the continuity and the repeating it, because you don't get it in one shot. You know, you get the words in one shot, just bringing you back to that same point again and again and again and again, putting in. And that vasa, it was all things, all compounded, phenomenal, impermanent. it's just another impermanent phenomenon, arising and passing away, letting go. That was the theme. You know, so there's all this stuff people are bubbling with, and it's another impermanent phenomenon, arising and passing away. As you're collapsing and going strange, it's another impermanent phenomenon, arising and passing away. Letting, yeah. And it's like, this guy's not wavering, you know, right there. And I said to him one day, I said, don't you ever get bored with all this Buddhism? You know, because I was pretty ugly and direct too. I said, "Didn't you get fed up with it all?" And he looked at me and said, "No, it's another impermanent phenomenon." And the beauty of it was that you could, in those days, there was only like half a dozen of us. You could all just bundle into his kuti, and we'd all have tea together, and you go bindabar together, and you just really rubbing up against each other all the time. And he was the thing that we all rubbed against, you know, all our weirdness and roughness. And he was the one thing that we all could rub up against and receive something. And he'd just take it and take it and take it and take it and stay steady and laugh and take it and stay steady. You know, and I'd come up with things. I'd say to him, "What? Why is it? Why is it that we eat cheese in the evening, we can't drink milk? This is silly. Why do we can't drink milk in the evening? We want to eat cheese. What kind of thing?" He says, "It's a crazy world." That's his answer. And you think, right, okay, got it. You know, you could feel this. It wasn't the answer, it was just the emotion. He wasn't defending, he wasn't justifying, he just laughing at it gently. Just, it's a crazy world, you know. And you could just see how you're getting yourself tied up and twisted up and infuriated. And he'd just go, you know, something that you could see what you were doing. And so, okay, who says how it should be? And you know, all right, let it go. Another impermanent phenomenon, let it go. And so that sense of continuity. And so I sort of picked up on that. So I tried to do the best I could. And we had arms round. So every day I'd go arms round. And it got tough at times because I didn't only had these sandals. And in the wintertime it was thick snow. And I remember walking, you know, these 3-mile bindabars through 2 foot of snow with sandals and your feet, you know, freezing. And you get back to the Vihara and, you know, Just go through that. But somehow the feeling of his continuity and his steadiness. And you just do this. Just do this. It doesn't have to make sense. You just do it. And he's very strong on that. To get beyond the justifying, thinking, reasoning mind, which would always keep bending things around. So that was during that rains then, just through that, let's say the teaching very simple, but the presence and the ability to absorb the various amounts of conflict and silliness that was going on without wavering. This is something else. So I decided I would stay and made it aditana to stay and try to help. Just thought, well, you got 300,000 monks in Thailand. You got 3 or 5 in Britain. I'll stay here. Help out. So I did. And then we went down to the next year, 79. During 78, the forest, the Hammer Wood, had already been offered, but there was various pieces of legal procedure to be tied up. So, and then I went down there, amazingly, with Lumpur Cha and Lumpur Samedo, and we looked around, and there's forest, but of course no property until the next year when George kind of, because the property in Somerset had been snatched up while everybody discussed whether it was worthwhile having or not. So they lost it. This one, he thought, I'll just get it. We won't talk about it, just get it. So he got some stick for that, but he got it. And so the next year, we got the house, we bundled on down to the house, to Chithurst House, and they tied up the legal arrangements around the Hammer Wood. So suddenly we had this thing. And it was, of course, wonderful, amazing, open, and a mess. A complete ruin. So for about all the time I was there, we just worked. We didn't just work, we had, guess what, morning puja, evening puja, 2 talks a day, and all that rises passes away and is not self. And, you know, just holding that line and this sort of immense mopping up, tidying up, arranging, working, grubby stuff happened around it. And he maintained that sense of being the central axis within that thing. And I think the first year we were there, his theme for the Vasa was, what is it that Buddhas know that unenlightened beings don't know? And he repeated this most every day. What is it that Buddhas know that unenlightened beings don't know? Everything that rises passes away and is not self. And you go, I said that yesterday. So what? But then you'd find out in a day that you hadn't really got the fact that everything rises and passes away is not self, because you're taking something very personally, got stuck on it, you know, didn't let it pass away. So you just go through that. And we were living in that situation, just with that kind of mantra. And, you know, that's the difference between a teacher and a book. Book, that's page one, let's turn over. The teacher just puts that there as a kind of a mooring post, a Dharma mooring post, while life washes over and you keep checking that teaching out against the flow of life as it hits you. You know, something you're holding on to, some sense of self, some sense of what you think you are and should be. Get it? So with that, we were able to be very flexible. The first 4 nuns were living in one room up in the house, 4 of them, trying to figure out that everything arises away is not self. And the rest of us were all crammed in little rooms with the rain coming in through the roof. And then Ajahn Amaro turned up and fell down in the basement and broke his arm. But it was not self either. And then we'd also still go Bindabad. First of all, he didn't want it to happen because he was concerned that people in West Sussex would get freaked out by it all because they'd been a bit feisty in their own way. And so we had a kind of meeting in the village hall where he tried to present, and he brought the English ones along to, so he wouldn't say things that might offend the very conservative sensibilities of West Sussex. And we tried to, you know, explain our position or non-position, and that BBC film arose. So we were there in the middle of West Sussex in a very, very conservative area. If you remember seeing the film, and we just worked all the time, did Bindabad, and we had all night sits, and I think, so we'd work from 8 in the morning till 5 at night, and then we'd have the evening puja, and then the Wompra all night sit, and then the next day we'd go down at 4 and get up at 6, and then get back to work. And I was learning the Patimokkha at that time as well. So it's an incredible amount of energy going on at that time. And he also had this kind of massive amount of faith, really, and energy, because during that time he was also going out to the Buddhist Society and White Eagle Lodge, and just about anybody invited me to go out and teach them. You know, Women's Institute, go out and teach them. Buddhist Society, go and teach them. Some kind of Theosophical Society, go and teach them. Whoever. He was just making contacts and presenting the image of the bhikkhu as being someone who was what he was, you know. Wasn't kind of hammering Buddhism down there into them, but just being his own presence and speaking very directly and very humorously. So he was even on a TV program, and they were called The Gods of War, and they were interviewing various religious leaders and about their attitude towards war. And so at one point, oh, Vinaya, we don't do that kind of thing. And somebody said, what about this Vietnamese monk who poured petrol over himself and set himself on fire? And Ajahn Sumedho said, well, that's his choice. Fortunately, don't expect me to do that. It was always bringing it down from the doctrinal to, you know, ideological to just the human quality. And I think that's the thing that people really got. Somebody wasn't just mouthing, you know, the official line, but talking very directly as a human being, and always with this kind of smile or laugh after it, and making it all very direct. And tremendous energy to do so, to just about anybody. So he had great faith, great energy, and he'd also, you know, he'd take on just about anybody on for training. I mean, some very strong characters. And then he'd also just push us out. Like I was, I think, my 5th Vasa, so I'd been in Britain 2.5 years. Just past my 5th Vasa, he said, go and teach a 10-day retreat up in Northumberland. They want somebody to teach you to go and teach a 10-day retreat in Northumberland. Oh, okay. You know, just past my 5th Vasa. And then I went up there, and the people there had been to his talks in Oakenholt, and they wanted to start a vihara. So he said, well, you go up there and start it. There was 5 vasas. So I went up there with Ajahn Chanapala, who was an Anagarika then, and someone era was Badi, or was he Tanavaro then? Do you remember? You know, Badia, I think. So there's just the 3 of us working in this dump up in Northumberland, which is now a very beautiful monastery, Aruna Ratnagiri. So we were up there. And the fact that he just did it. There was no book. There was no, this is what you do. There was no guidelines. Just, you know, practice, do the morning pujas, evening pujas, stay simple, do the work, stay as a community. That's it. And so we did that. So pushing you over your edge, deep end stuff. And so then we started Amrutwadi, and that was a huge leap in the dark. And so he took a group of us up to Amrawadi, and the nuns walked up there from Chithurst. This was set up to be their center, and he wanted to have a retreat center and a place where many, many lay people could come and practice, and there'd be things for families, because Chithurst didn't have the permission, was too small. So, okay, so we go up there. Okay, we go up here. And we found this place, which was like every other place that we've started, freezing cold and, you know, derelict, and just started working on that, and similar approach. And there, here's where, you know, he really seemed to live, really gain a lot, such confidence in his own vision and practice. He started to really, you know, his theme was the doors to the deathless are open. This is the doors to the deathless are open. Open up, bring everything in. We'll take it on. You know, that was the theme. And he still, of course, chants that when he begins a Dhamma talk. So, taking that on, this on, and we just followed and did what we could around his presence. And he had this enormous energy and persistence, both in teaching and also in his own practice, like a standard day. For Lumpur Sume to get up at 2, work out for an hour or so on his rowing machine, take a shower, you know, have a cup of coffee, meditate. So by morning puja, 5 o'clock, he was running. I mean, he came in like incandescent, you know. He was fired up, he was ready. He said, you really prepare yourself for the morning puja. So this is his favorite moment of the day. So he structure his day around coming to that morning puja like he was going to meet the Buddha, you know, and he had that quality to it. He came and he would sit and be there, and he'd often started this process of giving these kind of stream of consciousness recollections. He'd just start talking about his process, how he was reflecting on Dhamma, and he'd just be talking as it was arising in his mind. He'd just be expressing it, and we'd sort of sit there and let it wash over, and whatever bits landed or, you know, opened us up. And it was just that sense of a very open channel with him, letting it flow there. And that was probably the main event of the day for him, to set that up. And the example, you know, start at 2, prepare for the morning puja. You're going to meet the Buddha, you know, you're going to meet the Dhamma. It's not just, here we go again another day, but actually a special rising up, getting there, presenting the Dhamma, setting things up for the day. And then we do our chores, then we get to the breakfast, we all have breakfast together, and then he'd give another reflection over breakfast, and we'd sit there in our various states. Sometimes I must confess, looking at my tea and thinking, I wish he'd shut up so I can drink my tea. Such is the defilements of the mind. But he kept going. And eventually, you know, you gotta let go, it doesn't matter, you know, and just be with that. And then he'd carry on all day, and he'd see people after the meal and continue the evening puja, and then he'd, you know, go back to his kuti 9 or 10 or so and retire. So, and he'd do that regular. And it was like, for him, it was just the whole energetic, you know, tuning into Dhamma. And I think it was that kind of attitude of making himself available to Dhamma, almost like a channel where he prepare his body. And, you know, his body and his energy and his mind to carry that through for the community, the resident community, and for anyone who turned up. And so that huge energy, huge generosity, and huge patience. Because people would turn up, and there were some crazy people turning up. And they'd ask him these crazy questions, and he'd sit there and, you know, listen, listen, listen. People turn up, husband and wife are having a quarrel, a fight, and they turn up, and he'd sit and listen to it, and her side and his side, and he'd sit and listen to it. And, well, you need to, you know, advice. And I'd be going, oh, this is just tell them to shut up, sort themselves out. he said, well, you know, I mean, I'm just throwing out seeds. So I'm throwing out seeds. So you think, why bother with these people? You know, why bother with these people? And he said, well, you know, just in that sometime in a future life, they might have some recollection of having Buddhist monk, met a Buddhist monk who received them. That's good enough. I can do that much. You know, he'd prepare to throw out seeds that, and whoever. So they'd have some sense of having met a Buddhist monk who wasn't laying something on them or being righteous, and that quality. And he'd do that to just about anybody turned up. So, and he's still like that. You know, we, the rest of us have to start to guard it, because you realize despite that channel, there's a human being with that, and you want to protect it, because he will just keep putting it out there, you know. And so you're saying, look, Lumpur, please, let's retire, you know, go and take a rest, because you're 80 years old. but the immense kind of sacrifice that he would do. And with that, he'd still make a point of at least once a year going back to Thailand. And this was to go and pay respects to the Somdet Buddhajan and the Sangharaja, if that was possible. Sangharaja was available. Always Somdet Buddhajan, go and pay respects. And obviously to Wat Pa Pong while Lumbor Cha was alive. When Lumbor Cha passed away, he'd still go every year. It's sense of just constantly connecting back to the root time and time again, both for his own, I guess for his own, you know, connection, but also to maintain that sense for the Sangha in the West, that there's, we haven't split off. We're connected. We want to listen. We want to learn. We want to maintain our sense of kinship, so that then things can flow along properly. And he's still doing that. You know, he says he's retired, but he's still making connections in Thailand and bringing people over. And like this year, he brought over the abbot of successor to Somdet Buddhajan, Abbot Wat Saket, so that he would see the Sangha in Britain, our Sangha, and think, yeah, this is good, you know. And they respect, and they're with us, and we're connected, and just that. And he's still doing that. So immense sense of looking after, widening on one level to just about anybody who comes along, but also staying very true to the core lineage and the connection to that. And it's so important, because you think of a tree, and you see a tree, what you see is the stalk, the trunk, and the leaves and the branches growing up. The tree's getting bigger and bigger. But as every time it grows up, it also has to grow deeper and deeper roots, otherwise it's not going to last. You don't see the roots. You see the stem, you see the leaves, you see the branch, you don't see the roots. But the roots under the ground are as big as the amount of the tree that's above the ground. So even as the tree grows from a little sapling, it has to keep growing more and more, deeper and deeper roots to balance it. And so even as he was doing all the stuff in Britain, he was also deepening the roots to the Thailand and the Thai forest tradition, the Thai Ajahns. So they go around and visit, pay respects, stay connected, bring up any topics, listen to concerns, and do that for us. This isn't so glamorous, you know. This is hard work. And so, patience, generosity, constancy, energy, you know. And of course, I guess you could say equanimity, if you're looking at parami. And equanimity, there's no such thing as a smooth path to equanimity, right? Yeah. You know, to develop equanimity doesn't mean everything's going to be wonderful, does it? Equanimity means you have to experience the rocky stuff, the rough stuff, the disappointments, and the praise and the blame, the success and the failure, and stay accepted all. And, you know, again, you know, we see this amazing, wonderful thing that we can feel, you know, a tremendous amount of, oh, conviction, and this has been built. But, you know, I remember the year when Ajahn Anando disrobed and Kittisaro disrobed and Abhakra disrobed. And these were all people who he'd nurtured and had strong companionship with, and the feeling of these, you know, things breaking down, you know, you're trying to hold something together and then people are breaking down in it. And that's always part of Sangha life. Not just physical death, but also the disillusionments, the conflicts, you know, senior people getting disillusioned, not just juniors, senior people getting disillusioned, quarrels within the community, struggles over leadership, you know, him getting, and if you're the leader of a community, you know, there's no choice. It's not anybody's choice. You will always get the blame. It doesn't matter. That's the way it goes. It's not a rational thing. You know, you'll feel the sense of responsibility. If you're really going to be a leader, you're going to suffer because you accept responsibility, but you can't control things. You know, you accept the responsibility for everybody that's come, but you realize they're not going to be the way you want them to be. They're not going to be able to do what you want them to do. They're going to leave. Some will leave, some will stay. Of course, there'll be good ones and inspiring ones. We'll see the ones who get disillusioned or find fault with you and so forth. So, you know, and to be with that over 20 years, you know, Sangha is not, you know, it's turbulent. And we managed to contain that. We contain it because an example, I suggest an example like his. It's a very important one. You know, we could get ideological about, you know, rights and wrongs of meditation, but just the simplicity of that commitment, openness, presence. And, okay, you know, for some people, and because he loved the holy life so much, it would really, very warm-hearted, but also quite tender-hearted. And you certainly get profoundly affected with people being disillusioned in what he thought was so beautiful and valid and worked for him. So he'd really feel it. But he came through and he said, you know, eventually I recognize people are just working out their karma. Some will do this for a lifetime. Some will only do it for a year. You know, they're living out their karma. They're doing what they can. And you have to let it pass. You have to let it fail sometimes. You have to let it fall apart sometimes. You know, and that's equanimity, isn't it? The same as Amrawadi. He said, well, you know, when Amrawadi starts, people are naturally complaining about this and criticizing it because it's not like what it should be. And he said, well, you know, you try, and if the whole thing fails, so what? It's been a good experiment. It's been an interesting attempt. We try. If you don't try, why bother? You try, and it works for some people. Some people it doesn't, you still do it. And if the whole thing folds up, well, never mind. The Dhamma persists. And he'd always have that attitude. And I remember there's another kind of anecdote when there was Ajahn Anando was organizing a tudong on the South Downs, and he's inviting everyone to go on the South Downs. And I was saying, well, I don't know whether I should go, because surely we need to you know, be responsible and look after Amrawadi and make sure it's running. He said, look, I want to be able to just, if you want to go Tudong and it's good, we'll just hang a sign on the door saying, gone Tudong. You can come and sit here if you like. I want to be able to run it like that, that we can just say, okay, you know, it's like this. It's not super tranquil. It's not, you know, it's what it is. It's not super tranquil. It's not completely well organized. It's not perfectly figured out. You're not guaranteed to have brilliant teachings every day. It's this. It's an open door. If you want to be open and you want to practice, it's here. But don't bring your expectations. And so, you know, that sense of equanimity about whether people liked it or disappointed in it, and holding that, not they didn't feel anything, but able to maintain awareness of those feelings as that which arises passes, and being the knowing, which was another one of his great mantras, be the knowing, and abide in awareness. The world is like this. We used to have, at one time, when Amrawadi was still developing, early days, we used to have this session every few evenings. You get a car, the local yobbos, the local hooligans, would drive up the driveway in their car and screech around the courtyard and make noise. And sometimes they'd smash the donation boxes or the post boxes in the night time, or, you know, scream and howl and stuff like that. Yeah? Ring the bell. Yeah, so you say, how could they do this? And you say, the world is like this. This is the way it is. So we had all kinds of things. We had a kind of a night vigil where we take it in turns to walk around the monastery to intercept people. And then one monk had this bright idea of, he had a potato brigade. And the idea was you were given a potato. And if you saw a car park, you stuff the potato up the exhaust pipe. So that when they tried to drive away, the engine would fill with exhaust and it would break down. So we all were armed with potatoes on these potato vigils in a monastery. And I think one time they came and they had a bronze Buddha standing in the courtyard and they pushed it over. So this was the day before Wesak, and we came out on Wesak morning. There's the Buddha Rupa lying on its face in the dirt with a massive dent in its shoulder. And I'm looking at God, you know, so annoyed and upset. So how could people do this? He said, the world is like this. Wanting it to be another way is suffering. So he always had that kind of ability just to catch these points when you're about to, you know, blow up or get wound up about something. You just prick the bubble, you know. And many, many incidents like that. And it was that to me was the important thing. It's just, you know, he never prepared a talk. You know, his study capacity or his interest in studying is limited. He'll just pick up a particular phrase or one sutta and just reflect on it again and again and again and distill things out of it. But then you see the results in the actuality of daily life. And this is a strong characteristic of the forest teachers, particularly Lumpo Chan, Lumpo Sumedho, is just as you're doing stuff and stuff is happening, that's when he'd point it. You know, it's just as you're getting absorbed in something or irritated by something, that's when he'd actually present. And somebody was saying to me, they were today just asking a few people what their recollections were. And this monk was saying, well, he was really involved with a building project, looking at these things, making all the designs and getting really like that. And then Ajahn Sumedho came up and just took hold of his arm, squeezed it, gave a big smile, hello. You know, that's it. Just, you know, you're getting into your little bubble and then, hello, here we are, you know. Poof. And you can see the kind of mental landscape suddenly change. Many incidents like that. And so to me, that all that. And so really I found immense benefit just being around. And in those days, you know, it was still relatively early. You could still gain access. And I was privileged to be able to serve. I like serving. I enjoy serving actually more than leading. It's nice to be able to support. And so that I just go around every day. I think every day while I was here, while he was here, massage his feet. And that was really, I never massaged anybody's feet before. And just do that every day, get hot water, bathe his feet, and his big swollen foot, and we'd massage and press it. We didn't talk very much, a little bit maybe, but not much. And just feeling, you know, there's my teacher, holding, doing what I can, just in this very simple, earthy, human way. That's somewhere on my shrine too. I can't put a word for it, what it is, but that's there, along with many other recollections of what was so special. And, you know, when you live with Lumpo Samedo, or you live in areas and in monasteries that have had his presence, you kind of take it for granted. This is, yeah, this is Buddhism. We've done this. Let's do something else. We got this. And you don't recognize, how do you think this got here? You know, where would it have been without him? Who'd have, how do you think this building got here? He didn't build it, but he pulled the energy and the intelligence and the finances to make it happen. He pulled it in, you know. And how do you think it got here? How do you think you got to be able to be, come from, you know, all these different countries in the world, and Home Office grants you permission to stay here? How do you think that happened? Yeah. How do you think you get a visa to go to Thailand? You can go to another 20 monasteries in the world and be immediately accepted. How do you think that happened? You know, you can turn up to any monastery of Wat Pa Pong and they'll say, oh, okay, Lumpo Samedo, all right, here you are. How do you think that happened? You know, make the connections. Where does it all point to? Yeah, and you can kind of live in the monastery and think, oh yeah, great, I don't think much of this, I'm studying this, and Ajahn Sumedho's teachings, I've heard all that and so forth. But, you know, this is a time, you know, this being, this non-self presence, we gather together to, for the sake of a form, use his 80th birthday as a recollection. You know, it could be, you know, in some ways it's just another day. And, you know, some ways, who knows who this person is, formations. I think there's huge parami there, very special occasion that brought this around. Where would we be without that? I don't know where I'd be, but it wouldn't be very good. I'm pretty certain of that. You know, where would all this be without that? And how, you know, just consider in your own life, all of you who've come here, you've been part of something unparalleled, I say, in Western Buddhism. You know, how many other monastic foundations are there? Where do you think it came from? 9 monasteries, where do you know? Plus all these good connections. I go to America and they say, oh yeah, Ajahn Sumedho's monks, they're the ones you can trust, they're really solid. Where do you think it came from? So this is, you know, what I take with me and recollect this incredible occasion that's happened in Britain for all of us, and something we can carry in our minds and hearts. I hope you all have some anecdote for yourself, some occasion when you heard something he said that went, something, or something he did that you went, oh, you know, maybe that was only one thing for you. But to me, this is the important piece. You don't know, but you just take the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 pieces that are there and realize, where would you be without those? And that's what we are, in a way, all of us honoring, our own images, our own impressions, our own Ajahn Sumedho, and the being who has helped, has made that present for us. So I offer this for your reflection this evening.